Teaching about the Holocaust is a daunting prospect. Human suffering on a scale few adults can fathom, let alone school kids learning about this history for the first time. It's also fraught with the potential for unintentionally signaling that toxic anti-Jewish prejudice as a driver of evil in the world imploded along with the Third Reich. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sadly, anti-Semitic attitudes and violence continue to make the world unsafe for Jews around the world and in the United States. And my guest worries that despite sincere and benevolent intentions, the way some institutions do Holocaust education in this country is failing to address these ongoing threats. Dara Horn is author of the essay collection People Love Dead Jews, Reports from a Haunted Present. Her recent article for The Atlantic was titled, Is Holocaust Education Making Anti-Semitism Worse? Dara, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your book was published 2 years ago, and I take it you were braced for a lot of really ugly anti-Semitic backlash directed toward you. On top of that, though, you kept hearing from other Jewish people about their experiences. What kinds of stories were they sharing?
Yes. Yeah, so as you mentioned, I did get a fair amount of anti-Semitic hate mail and things like that, which is unfortunately just normal for writers on this topic. But what really surprised me was the responses that I got from many of my Jewish readers. And the kinds of things they would share with me were just personal experiences with anti-Semitism in America. And these were the kinds of things that don't make it onto, FBI hate crime list or something like that. So beyond that, things like just tolerating, bosses and colleagues making anti-Semitic jokes, kids being ridiculed in school. I couldn't believe how many people are having pennies thrown at them in 21st century America. I mean, this is like a very old anti-Semitic taunt that I thought died decades ago. And what was really striking to me was how many of my readers who shared these experiences with me, they often would preface it with, "I never told anyone this before, but." These people were almost ashamed to share this with me. And what they really were, and some of these things were even, violent attacks, that didn't result in a fatality, so it didn't make the news. But, these were really life altering kinds of experiences. And what I noticed was that they tended to be ashamed of these experiences. They didn't want to really talk about them. They had never talked about them before. And as many of them said, like, "Oh, well, it's really not a big deal. It's not like the Holocaust." And I'm thinking, well, the bar there is a little high for what we're considering a problem.
Right. So saying it's not like the Holocaust is like saying suffering doesn't matter because it's not on that scale. That's how people were made to feel.
And not just, yes. And also that there was something that had happened in our culture where the way that many people in our country learn about anti-Semitism, if they learn about it at all, is through Holocaust education. And what that means is that what people learn anti-Semitism consists of is genocide. And then it seems like anything short of genocide sort of feels like no big deal. And that was what was really striking to me. I mean, the things that my readers were describing were often, major things where it was, a threatened attack on a synagogue. These were things that, my readers were sort of just accepting as if this was normal.
So lots of people have hoped that Holocaust education might play a role in like choking off anti-Semitic ideas, especially among young people. You set off on this, I guess, kind of tour of Holocaust museums around the country to see that teaching in action. Is that right?
Yes. Well, and not just museums. I also, I met with a lot of people who are educators who design curricula that are used in schools. I met with state legislators who were involved in passing mandates for Holocaust education in various states. I talked to teachers. I met with students. So it was beyond just visiting museums. And what I discovered is, as you said, is this was this real almost a faith in the idea that Holocaust education was the way to combat anti-Semitism. And it was almost like a reflexive thing that people would do. Many of these states had passed Holocaust education mandates after seeing a spike in anti-Semitic hate crime in their state. Often there would be these events where, you know, a public figure would say something anti-Semitic, and then the response would be to invite that person to go to a Holocaust museum. When there were anti-Semitic incidents in schools, the schools would often respond by, you know, teaching some kind of lesson related to the Holocaust. And there was this bedrock faith that Holocaust education prevents or inoculates people against anti-Semitism. And I really was really to looking around the country and asking this question, is it working?
I want to be really clear here that you do not oppose teaching about the Holocaust in schools. You don't oppose Holocaust museums or their mission to share history. You just don't think they can accomplish all the social good people have hoped. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Yes. I want to be clear about that too. Holocaust education is absolutely essential. And one of the reasons it's essential, unfortunately, is because one sort of narrow form of anti-Semitism is Holocaust denial and distortion. So this is a hugely important history for people to learn about, not only just because of the magnitude of this atrocity, but also because we are up against hateful people who are denying that this happened. So it's absolutely essential. And you know, it's essential for a lot of other reasons too, just in terms of understanding things like the fragility of democracy, for example. But what I came to conclude was that Holocaust education, I feel, is incapable of addressing contemporary anti-Semitism. And that was what was striking to me about that is that that was often, it's the origins of American Holocaust education came from people who really had that hope in mind. And I felt that that was the aspect of it that had failed.
You take us first in this essay to Skokie, Illinois. How did this community, of all places, become one of the first to establish an institution to deal with the Holocaust?
Yes. So Skokie, Illinois, which is it's a suburb of Chicago, and it's sort of is one of the origin points of Holocaust education in America for a very specific reason. In 1977, the American Nazi Party, which thankfully, fringe group then and now. But in 1977, the American Nazi Party applied for a permit to march in uniform in this town of Skokie, Illinois. And they were deliberately targeting Skokie because this was a town with number one, a large Jewish community, and number two, it was a large population of Holocaust survivors at that time within that community. And the town sort of tried various means to block this march from happening. It became a huge court case that made it to the Supreme Court. And ultimately the law sided with the Nazis because of the First Amendment, because of the defense of free speech. But as it turned out, this Nazi party ended up never marching in Skokie at all, in part because this sort of court battle launched this huge public backlash. And part of that public backlash came from Jewish Holocaust survivors in Skokie, who prior to that really hadn't talked about their experiences very much in public. And this event inspired them to come out of the woodwork and share their experiences. And in a sense, what they realized was that if they were looking for ways to protect people from anti-Semitism, what they realized was that American law couldn't really help them in this sense because we have the First Amendment. They weren't going to be able to block this march. And they thought, well, what else can we do to protect people from anti-Semitism? And at that point, they pivot to education. And so it's really started by this community of Holocaust survivors. They created one of the first Holocaust museums in the United States. Originally, it was in a small storefront. This is now the Holocaust Museum in Skokie, Illinois, is one of the largest Holocaust museums in the country. And they also successfully passed a mandate in the state of Illinois, one of the first mandates for Holocaust education in public schools. So, and this was really, they were very convinced that this was a solution to inoculating the American public against anti-Semitism. So that's the origin, one of a few origin stories for American Holocaust education.
So residents of Skokie today, Jewish and non-Jewish alike, are rightly proud of this museum, and yet. So what did you learn when you went to Skokie to observe how Holocaust education there is carried out?
So this is the museum there. In my piece, I called it a victim of its own success because it's a very large museum. It's, as I said, I think it's perhaps the second largest or certainly one of the largest Holocaust museums in America. I called it a victim of its own success because they have so many school groups that come to that museum that they have to, they can't even put the school groups through the museum in chronological order. You know, they have to sort of shuffle people around. It becomes very crowded. But what was really interesting to me about it was, in that case, I followed a field trip around the museum. And I also had the opportunity to speak with people at the museum who, you know, people who designed the museum, designed educational programs there. It was striking to me how there was this effort to sort of promote this narrative that Jews are just like everyone else. And that was, that was the main thing that they were presenting to students about Jewish culture. And that doesn't mean that's the only thing in the museum about Jewish culture, but that's very much the mission that they were presenting to seventh graders, for example, who were coming to the museum is, you know, look how normal these people are. Look how they're just like everyone else. And you know, defining Judaism as a religion, for example. And the truth is Jewish culture is far beyond a religion. It has, it's a type of social group that transcends religion. It includes all kinds of other aspects of culture, which is why we have many secular Jews. And there was sort of this desire to sort of put this into a box of these were just, you know, people just like you and me, people just like everyone else, and look how horrible this was. And, you know, my problem with that attitude is that Jews spent 3,000 years not being like everyone else. You know, Judaism is this counterculture that runs through the history of the West. This is actually really a unique culture. And the Nazi project was not just about murdering 6 million Jews. It was about erasing Jewish civilization. And it occurred to me that in a sense, these museums, in a very noble effort to try to sort of, you know, gain empathy for people who died in the Holocaust, in a sense, this type of approach, which is certainly not unique to that museum, was in a sense participating in that erasure, because if we're sending this message to students that, you know, you shouldn't hate people because they're just like you and me, what you're in a sense saying is that if they're not exactly like you and me, then it is fine to hate them. And I mean, and obviously the museum's not intending to say that, but I think that there's something about this erasure of Jewish identity as it's presented, and certainly in the erasure of living Jews as it's presented, because you don't really learn anything about living Jewish communities today by going to these museums.
Dara, why do you think the museums tend to focus on Judaism as a religious identity rather than an ethnic identity?
I think that's comfortable for people. And this is something that non-Jewish societies have always done, which is to put Jews in whatever identity box they know best, so to speak.
Like a familiar framework, right?
Yes, right. And so that's why in this country you often have discussions about Jews being a religion, because that's sort of something that's comfortable for people. It's familiar. The reality is that Jews predate the modern category of religion. Jews predate the category of race, ethnicity, nationality. Jews predate all of these boxes, and in a sense, we're sort of trying to put Jews into a box. Jews are actually a type of social group that was common in the ancient Near East, but very uncommon in the West today. And I would describe this, as I did in this piece, as it's a joinable social group or a joinable tribal group. So joinable is important because, of course, people can become Jewish. A joinable tribal group with a shared history, homeland, and culture. Part of that culture is a non-universalizing religion. When I say non-universalizing, I mean there isn't any desire on the part of Jews to, you know, convert others, although people, of course, can convert to Judaism. It's not, there's no proselytizing. So, you know, that what I just said is a whole paragraph. In Hebrew, that's one word. So, you know, so I mean, there's, it's just a different way of understanding a group identity that we don't really have. We don't really have that in this country. So what we have instead is this country trying to sort of put Jews into the box that it knows best. And that way it's comfortable for people to say, oh, Jews are a religion. Oh, this was a prejudice against a religious group. When, of course, that's really not what it was. It requires a little bit more diving in to understand that. But it also requires understanding who Jews are in order to answer that question of, you know, what does it mean to be bigoted against Jews? You kind of have to understand who Jews are. And if your understanding is they're a religious group, you're going to miss a lot.
And to dive even deeper on this, throughout history, people who have committed violence against Jews have not been interested in whether they were actively practicing or practicing nothing or believed nothing or had taken on a different religion. This has never been like a distinction that anti-Semites made.
Usually not. There are some versions of anti-Semitism where this happens. I think that there's a point, and I don't talk about this in the piece, but So there's historians who have pointed to the Spanish Inquisition as an example of this. There was a large Jewish population in Spain at the time of when the Inquisition becomes powerful there. They had expelled the Jews from Spain, but many Jews converted to Christianity and then did not, and remained in Spain. And then the Inquisition sort of was coming after those people, even if they had converted to Christianity, to persecute them. And that's, in some historians will look at that as the beginning of like almost like a racial idea of Jewish identity, where it didn't even matter. Even the people who had become, faithful Christians were still being persecuted. So yes, you're correct. There was, it doesn't really matter to anti-Semites how people express their Jewish identity. It's there's something where this is being defined from the outside, and also there's a deeper misunderstanding of what it means to be Jewish, which is perhaps a broader definition than many people will allow.
What kinds of texts are used to teach about the Holocaust to kids in school?
Oh boy. So there's a lot of problematic aspects of this. One thing that I discovered in researching this topic and talking to teachers is how often fiction was being used to teach about this. There are a lot of, one book that a lot of educators told me about, which is hugely problematic, is this popular novel from, I think it's about 15 years old now. It's a book called The Boy in Striped Pajamas. Almost every educator I spoke with was condemning the use of this book to teach about the Holocaust, because it's completely ahistorical. It tells this sort of moralizing tale that ends up sort of being about this non-Jewish boy being a savior, and it's completely invented, and none of the things in it make any sense. But it makes people feel good about themselves. Mm. And that's something that I noticed in a lot of the works that were being used, even a work like The Diary of Anne Frank, which is not fiction. This is a diary kept by a Jewish teenage girl who was hiding from the Nazis and was being assisted by non-Jews who were helping to hide her and her family and others. The problem with those kinds of stories, example is a book called Number of the Stars, which is a fictionalized account of the rescue of Jews in Denmark by non-Jews. It's a lot of stories about non-Jews rescuing Jews during the Holocaust. And I think that the very well-intentioned idea behind that is to try to show some sort of inspirational story and sort of give people hope and make people want to be, as the parlance now goes, an upstander, meaning the opposite of a bystander. I think that that's the well-intentioned idea behind that. The problem is that non-Jews who rescued Jews during the Holocaust were statistically insignificant. I think the current count of people who participated in these rescue efforts is about 30,000 people out of a European population at the time of 300 million.
So not a lot of upstanders.
Yeah, not a whole lot of upstanders. And it was an extremely atypical experience for Jews to be rescued by non-Jews. Statistically insignificant. And, I think that there's this romanticizing of history and this desire to sort of tell this inspirational story, which is simply just not true to the reality of the Holocaust. And that was very disturbing to me.
I mean, this idea of certain kinds of Holocaust education being, feeding a kind of flattering self-concept is really interesting to me, in that, like, presumably nobody visiting a museum has taken part in a genocide. Therefore, we might fail to identify and examine harmful biases we do hold.
Yes. So, one of the premises in my book, People Love Dead Jews, is that people tell stories about dead Jews that make them feel better about themselves. And counterintuitively, the Holocaust is one of those stories, because, as you say, you go to a museum or you learn about this in school or watch a documentary about the Holocaust, and hopefully you feel terrible about what happened, but you feel wonderful about yourself because you're like, I would never do this. It's like, well, okay. I mean, that's a low bar to clear. Right? It's like, yes. I mean, there's something flattering about this. I think also, especially in an American context, this emphasis on the Holocaust. I mean, the Holocaust didn't happen in the United States, right? I mean, in a sense, Americans are often cast as the heroes in this story. Look, we're part of the Allies who liberated the camps. Of course, that's a bit of a distortion as well, in terms of, this country could have done a lot to rescue Jews from the Holocaust by opening up the gates to refugees, which, as hopefully more people are learning now, is not what happened. So yes, there is something self-congratulatory about this story that I find very disturbing.
We still struggle in this country to talk about horrific human rights abuses that we have committed. But you note that at a place like the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where there is a lot of material about slavery, there's also coverage of Black struggles after emancipation and also a lot of coverage of the triumphs of Black culture in this country.
Yes. Well, and so this was something that, I found very commonly around Holocaust museums and Holocaust education curriculum around the country. You have an example of this here in Dallas. There's the Dallas Holocaust and Human Rights Museum. And you can, as you can even just see from the name, even if you haven't been to that museum, there's this contextualizing of the Holocaust where it's being, the story is being told outside of history. It's almost like extracted from history as this case study. But you know, when you get to the end of the Holocaust in the historical parts of these museums or curricula, 1945, we don't then find out usually what happens to Jewish communities after that. Instead, the museum often will segue to, and not just the museum, but many you know, curricula and school lessons and things like that, it ends up being a discussion about other genocides, right? Or other minority struggles. And then often there's an attempt to sort of get people to be interactive. You know, what are you going to do to fight against bigotry and that sort of thing? This seems so noble. I feel so bad even criticizing this because it's, you know, there's so much good intention here. But as you say, if you go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., it doesn't stop at 1865. The museum doesn't say here, it's not a museum of American slavery. It's a museum of African American history and culture. And it doesn't say, look, yay, we freed the slaves and now we're done. And then you don't walk out of the exhibit about American slavery and then walk into another exhibit about enslavements around the world. And, you know, an interactive center about, you know, human trafficking is still happening today. What are you doing to prevent human trafficking? And the reason it's not designed that way is because that would be insulting to Black history. Because then what we would be doing is just taking this experience that this group has of past oppression, a very particular aspect of it, and erasing all of their experiences since then. And also erasing all of the agency of this community, right? Because then it becomes this sort of savior narrative where it's like, oh, look, you know, people came in and freed the slaves. And it's not about this community, then it would make them into these passive victims. And what was really striking to me is that's exactly what happens when you, in most examples of American Holocaust education, you know, the story about the Jews stops in 1945. And this was something I heard from a docent at the Dallas Holocaust and Human Rights Museum. I asked one of the docents, you know, what do students typically ask you when they come on these field trip tours? This was really shocking to me. He said, you know what a lot of students ask? They ask, are there still Jews who are alive today?
Wow.
Because if you came to this museum, you might not know. Huh. And of course, you know, the museum may have a few panels here and there about Jewish life, but I mean, that is not the story of the museum. It really, there's a complete erasure of living Jews to the point where a student would go to this museum and have no idea that there are still Jews alive today. That was really striking to me. And I thought there's something disturbing about the fact that the Nazi project was about erasing living Jews, and completely, perhaps unintentionally, these curricula are erasing living Jews.
Something else that frustrated you was, you know, when this kind of bystander, upstander philosophy is presented, Jewish resistors are usually not classified among the upstanders, right? Like as if all Jews were entirely passive and might only have survived had some Gentile had the guts to stand up for them.
Yes. So that was very disturbing to me. There's many of these curricula and museums and presentations of this story will often say there are four types of people who lived through the Holocaust. There's perpetrators, victims, bystanders, and then this term that is now ubiquitous in Holocaust education, upstanders. Upstanders being the opposite of a bystander, right? Someone who stood up and, you know, did the right thing when no one else did or something like that. These are non-Jewish people who are rescuing Jews. And first of all, one problem with that framework is that you then see that Jews only are put into one category. This framework assumes that Jews are not making moral choices. Only non-Jews are making moral choices. Jews are just in this passive victim category. And what's interesting to me is that These museums and curricula do talk about Jewish resistance during the Holocaust. They do teach you about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and many uprisings at many other ghettos and camps and also other forms of resistance that Jews that caught in this nightmare were engaging in. What disturbed me though is that you would then go to the other parts of the museums and or parts of the curriculum where they would be talking about this upstander idea and encouraging you as a visitor to take this home to your own life. And often when they would present this post-Holocaust history about upstanders, they would often present people like Martin Luther King as an upstander or Malala Yousafzai as an upstander. And what troubled me about that is that those were people who were standing up for their own groups, right? I mean, someone like Malala, as she's known, this is a young woman who was standing up for women's rights, right? Someone like Martin Luther King, obviously standing up for the rights of the Black community. But what I noticed is that Jews were not put into that category of upstanders when they were standing up. They were, in other words, there was this understanding that Jews were not expected to stand up for themselves. And it occurred to me there are many people who you could have put into these sort of upstander galleries of, Jews who stood up for Jewish, for Jewish communities that were being oppressed after the Holocaust. People from the Islamic world where Jews were expelled from their homes where they'd lived for thousands of years, Jews from the former Soviet Union. Obviously, there's many people who you could highlight in Israeli history, and that was just completely being ignored. And that was really disturbing to me because it seemed to be sending this message that Jews are not supposed to stand up for themselves.
Dara, what do you know about why so many of these Holocaust museums and education facilities in the United States went in this direction to sort of create a through line from the Holocaust to more modern examples of genocide and human rights abuses?
Well, there's a few reasons, but part of it comes from I mentioned earlier in our conversation the origins of Holocaust education in America from this neo-Nazis in Skokie, Illinois, and how Holocaust survivors sort of just made this decision to speak out about their experiences. There's another aspect of the origins of this education system that come from an educational trend in the 1970s toward what used to be called affective learning. This was the idea that there should be more leadership education essentially in schools and that we should be teaching more soft skills like character education and things like that. And this is sort of an educational trend that waxes and wanes. And what happened is that a lot of these educators latched onto the Holocaust as a sort of way of teaching morality in a secular society. And because the reason that they chose that was because there was this idea, oh, this is so obviously clear, right? I mean, everyone in education could agree that, the Nazis were evil and the Jews were innocent victims, and presenting this to students was going to be some way to activate their moral faculties. The problem with this is, there's a few problems with this. One problem, as we talked about before, is that it flatters everyone, right? I mean, if your standard is don't commit genocide, a lot of us are going to meet that standard, hopefully, in our lifetime. But the other problem is that, it eliminates the need to discuss anti-Semitism. Then we end up sort of just talking about hatred in general. And what happens at that point is that by not talking about anti-Semitism specifically, the dynamics of anti-Semitism as distinct from other bigotries, you allow space for it to grow because you're not talking about it. There's something in education that educators sometimes will call the null curriculum, which is what you don't talk about in schools. And when you present the Holocaust, but you don't present the history of anti-Semitism that preceded it for thousands of years, and you don't present how anti-Semitism continued beyond the Holocaust, what you basically end up teaching is that anti-Semitism is something that happened in Europe between 1933 and 1945. It consisted of genocide and now it's over.
I want to talk a little bit about these holograms, and it's for a long time in the early history of these kinds of institutions, survivors were invited to come and tell their stories, speak about their experiences. It's been a long time. A lot of these folks have since died. What did the museum in Skokie do to try and preserve the possibility for visitors of having something like an interaction with a survivor?
Yes. So this was a project that was actually, it was the Skokie Museum participated in it. It was actually run by the USC, University of Southern California Shoah Foundation. And the project was designed because of this idea that, you know, survivors are aging, very few of them are left, and that the museums had found that was, you know, that visitors always really appreciated interacting with Holocaust survivors. And so what they did was they turned these people into holograms. There was a handful of survivors who were sent to this USC Shoah Foundation in Los Angeles. They filmed them for 40 hours with this, you know, special camera equipment. During these 40 hours, they asked them thousands upon thousands of questions. And what you now have is, these people have since died. And what you now have, and you have it here in Dallas too, actually, the Dallas Holocaust and Human Rights Museum also features this technology. They have a theater in the museum where you can go and they show a hologram of this person, and it's enabled with artificial intelligence. So you can ask them questions and they'll answer you, almost like a Holocaust Siri. You know, and toward the end of the piece, I talk about, like, imagine all of the other things we could do with this technology to tell stories of Jewish communities that are thriving today. And it just sort of, it made me sad that this was sort of the thing that we were using this technology for. And it wouldn't have made me sad if there existed other popular ways and you know, cutting edge ways for people to learn about the content of Jewish civilization, but you know, that's not what's on offer.
Writer Dara Horn's recent article for The Atlantic was titled, "Is Holocaust Education Making Anti-Semitism Worse?" Dara, this has been really interesting. Thanks for making time to talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.